Thanks for inviting me. So if you work in extra dimensions, I'm going to talk about something you should be thinking about. As far as I can tell, not many people are thinking about it. And it accounts for what I would say is half the physics in a theory, typical theory. A typical example of this is QCD, where you might choose to write a chiral Lagrangian of mesons. And if you do that, you'll discover that the pion actually has its own parity. It has nothing to do with the parity of spacetime. You might conclude, therefore, the pion is stable. And in fact, you might also conclude a lot of physical processes, such as KK bar goes to 3 pions, cannot occur. But then you find the phi meson, and it decays to KK bar and 3 pions, so something's missing. And what's been left out is things that are inherited holographically from 5 dimensions, which you have to include into the Lagrangian, and these are known as the Vesemino-Witten term effects. And I've been interested for a long time in the exact relationship between 5-dimensional Yang-Mills and the 4-dimensional chiral Lagrangian. And so I doubt I'll get through it in great detail, but I will show you that, in fact, these are exactly the same thing. We've really inherited a 5-dimensional Yang-Mills structure with mesons, essentially as the 5th component of the vector potential, and the full topological aspect of this theory into the 4-dimensional chiral Lagrangian. And what this means is that most of the models people are playing with today that have that sort of generic behavior are going to have things like this. And in fact, what we're doing right now, I had hoped to have it ready to talk about, but not quite there, is show you how little Higgs theories will have Vesemino-Witten terms, highly non-trivial, and that contain a lot of interesting physics that you would otherwise leave out. Physics that may even be relevant at the ILC. So all of this revolves around the D=5 Chern-Simons term. And I'm going to begin more or less pedagogically with QED. I'm going to put QED in 5 dimensions. And in 5 dimensions, the photons will propagate in the bulk. However, QED is not just naively lifted into 5 dimensions and replaced by the 5-dimensional Dirac action, insofar as you want to maintain the technical naturalness of the small electron mass. And so what you have to do is chiral delocalization in 5 dimensions. You have naturally chirality in 4 dimensions. The electron has a left-handed component and a right-handed component. If you set the mass of the electron to 0, you have a U1 left plus U1 right chiral symmetry, which means the phase rephasing of the left-handed electron is independent of the right-handed. That's broken by the electron mass term that unites the fields, and therefore it makes the electron mass technically natural. In 5 dimensions, we want to preserve that, and we want to therefore chirally separate the left from the right. So we want essentially 2 brains, one with the left attached to it, another with right, 2 4-dimensional manifolds with the photons in the bulk, if you want to maintain this. Once you do that, however, you've put anomalies on the left-hand brain, you put anomalies on the right-hand brain. The theory is not consistent. It's a very basic statement that if I have a current that's coupled to a gauge field, this must be true. And the reason, of course, is that del mu f mu nu is j nu, and f mu nu is anti-symmetric, so del nu of f mu nu must be 0, therefore the current must be conservative. Any gauge theory is completely inconsistent. If you couple to a massless gauge field, massless is important. If it's massive, then I'm allowed to have an anomaly. And then you see that the anomaly is the source term for del dot A. Well, if you consider the longitudinal component of this massive thing, which is some gradient of a scalar, this is just the equation of motion of the axion. So if you can consistently put an axion into the theory and eat it to give mass to this object, it still has to have consistency relations. Yeah, the axion source would be FF dual. Then you can have an anomaly as a source term. But for the massless case, absolutely must conserve the current. And this is accomplished by having something called a Chern-Simons term. And these are remarkable objects. And what will happen is the Chern-Simons term will fill the bulk. And under a gauge transformation, the left-hand action over here will develop an anomalous FF dual. But the Chern-Simons term endpoint, its holographic left-handed endpoint, will compensate that. for a special choice of its coefficient. And likewise, the right-handed fermion will generate an anomaly that transcends trivial compensator. This implies a quantized coefficient of the Chern-Simons term, and we'll then dive into the difference between what are called consistent and covariant anomalies, which very few people in the field seem to understand. Just telling Jack how I got into this originally by reading a paper by some very famous people on the East Coast, who I consider friends and they're true gentlemen. However, the very first equation in their paper is dead wrong for anomaly reasons, and that propagates all the way through. That got me inspired to redo that work, and it led to all of this, and it bears no resemblance to the starting point. And I then traced back why that mistake was made, and I found that the literature is full of mistakes in understanding anomalies. In this particular case, the authors said, well, we look up Adler's paper, and we see that the axial current is 1 over 8 pi square FFT. And therefore, if I have a left-handed fermion, just a vial spinner, its current must be 1 over 16 pi squared of that fuel. It's absolutely wrong. And it completely misses the whole business of how these things are intertwined. So I want to show you. And as I say, this is not the first time this appears in the literature. This goes way back. So people didn't really, in the old days, the Adler era, I'm going to argue this is the way to think about QED. If you want to understand anomalies, this is the way to do it, because this makes everything precise. And if you go back to the old papers, you see people throwing counter terms around and talking about defining the loop structure correctly. This completely avoids it and makes it completely unambiguous. Now, people then, you often hear say, well, okay, but that's all the Chern-Simons term does. It just provides holograms that take care of anomalies on brains. Well, that's not true either. The Chern-Simons term fills the bulk. And if you consider the very high KK modes of the theory, with very large KK mode momentum, you can localize wave packets of these objects in the middle of the bulk, away from the brains. And they will interact with each other through the Chern-Simons term. So the Chern-Simons term gives rise to new interactions. And what it will do in particular is it will define the parity of the KK mode tower relative to space-time, just like the pion parity is defined relative to space-time. So I think what it does, and I never quite get straight whether this is your T parity or not, but maybe it is. I think it's defining T parity as a parity of space-time. And the limit in which this is interesting is the limit in which you take the electron mass large compared to the first few KK modes in the tower and integrate the electron out. And when you do this, the Chern-Simons term becomes an interaction amongst KK modes, permitting a decay of the first the nth KK mode to the mth KK mode plus photon. And we'll see that the Chern-Simons term, because it's maintaining the gauge invariance, protects you and maintains the Li-Yang theorem. I'm sorry, the Landau-Yang theorem. And you do not ever have KK mode go to 2-0 modes. So that becomes an explicit check. That's what I'm going to do with QED. And then time permits, show you what happens with Yang-Mills on a symmetric S1. The reason this is interesting is, well, here we'll put quarks on the two brains, and these are quarks with flavor. So SU3 left, SU3 right, and we'll have SU3 gauge field propagating the bulk. And what will happen is if we compactify in any way that yields an A5-0 mode. So people typically like to do this on S1. I like to use what's called a flipped orbifold, which has not received much attention in the literature either. It's flipping the parity assignments that Harava and Witten give on orbifold fields. It gives you exactly the QCD spectrum. It gives a pion 0 mode made of A5, then it gives the rho, octet, and then it gives the A1. It's the first KK mode above it, etc. So the flipped orbifold is quite interesting, and that's an example of something that would do this. F pi is just related to 1 over r, and you have a Wilson line mass term, which represents the chiral condensation. It's sort of like the chiral constituent quark model. Again, you need a Chern-Simons term because you've chirally delocalized, and this is in some sense being interpreted dynamically. This is interesting in the sense that the compactification of this manifold is acting like the psi-bar-psi vacuum condensation, the thing that spontaneously breaks the chiral symmetries. And what happens now is the Chern-Simons term will compactify down and produce the full Vesemino-Witten term. Now, the full Vesemino-Witten term, if you've never seen it, is a real monster. It's an enormously complicated interaction. It's very hard to manipulate. It was initially, the leading order part is a 5 pion interaction, which measures pi 5 of SU3, or pi 5 of S5, because S5 is contained in SU3, the mapping of the 5 sphere under the 5 sphere. And so it contains a form that looks like this, pi, d pi, d pi, d pi, d pi trace. I warn you, I'll get into form notation later. So it's just an epsilon symbol tying all those together. And that contains k dagger, d pi meson, d pi meson, d pi meson, d k. So it contains kk goes to 3 pi. And this was derived originally by Vesemino. Actually, in Bardeen's classic paper on anomalies, he had actually discovered this, but his referee told him to take it out. And Vesemino came along shortly thereafter and got this. Witten showed how to get the coefficient by a quantization argument that's similar to the Dirac magnetic monopole. Dirac monopoles play an important role in if you want to understand the coefficients of Chern-Simons terms, you can get them in any dimension, almost on the back of an envelope, by generalizing the idea of Dirac's monopole to any odd d. This is a typical example of holography, where calculating these diagrams is an enormous amount of work. I've done it. I put a technical memo on the web, running out of this, in which this is done for the vial spinner, the massless vial spinner, because I couldn't find it in the literature. And it's to me, the basic edit one. I figured it's known to people. I mean, it's implicit in Bill Bardeen's paper, but he actually does the massive case. So the pure left-handed spinner, this is a hard calculation. Just do it, and it works. It's the current divergence here, and it gives the basic anomaly, which turns out to be 1 over 48 pi squared f of u for J. Wright. And, there's a lot of work, but getting that coefficient you can do in the back of an envelope if you figure out how to put the Dirac monopole in 5 dimensions. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that. This is a typical example of a semi-classical, easy calculation in the back of an envelope giving something that's an enormous amount of work if you do it in 4 dimensions. But anyway, this thing was done by Vest and Zanino, and then Witten asked the question, how do you gauge it? And Witten went into 6 dimensions where he added he wrote this operator, and then this can be written as d of this, and so in 6 dimensions you can integrate over the surface term, and then you just erase this, and you have a 5-dimensional interaction. Actually, it was a product of 6 chiral currents. This is the leading order term of expansion. We'll see how it works. Witten asked the question, how do you gauge this? Which is a very ambiguous question. You've put the pions in 6 dimensions, in 5 dimensions, and then you're asking how to gauge this object in 4 dimensions, and the gauge invariance is broken by the object itself. So the beauty of this is that you start with Yang-Mills in 5 dimensions, and you insist on maintaining gauge invariance. The pions are born when you descend to 4 dimensions because they become the Wilson line between 2 grids. You've got a brain here and a brain here. Path-ordered exponential line integral of A5 becomes my pions, okay, from here to here. And then you just work hard, and you'll find that this stuff descends into the fully gauged Vesemino-Witten terms. All the gauging is a bunch of exact differentials, 5 dimensions, and you can write it down. That's what contains phi to kk bar, phi to 3 pi, pi to 2 gamma, etc. And that's what would be present in any extra-dimensional model where you have chiral delocalization. So Agashi models, we have Randall syndrome, and we have the top right on the IR brain, the rest of the fermions on the UV brain, that'll have this sort of structure. And the Kaplan-Schmaltz model is something we're studying in detail, and that can be viewed in this language, and it has a very non-trivial, surprisingly non-trivial Vesemino-Witten term structure. And you get into something kind of novel called nonlinear realizations. I could talk in private about that. It won't be part of this talk. Here's some papers. This will be the one that comes out soon on Little Higgs. This exact equivalence. This is quite technical. This is very readable and somewhat pedagogical. These are lecture notes. This stuff began in using dimensional deconstruction to go after topology. I couldn't get the full matching. We got part of the way. But we did discover some interesting things about formulating chiral Lagrangians through the dimensional deconstruction game. And then I got finally this correspondence in the continuum. And then Bill Bardeen said, well, it must be possible to get this thing. So he did it in reverse. He took the full gauge Vesalino term and he viewed it as a lattice structure, and he just took the small lattice limit and saw it go back into the Chern-Simons term. So I was a little bit envious of that. I should have figured that one out myself. That worked pretty smoothly. But although it doesn't work, some of the terms just go away, become zero. So the exact equivalence is quite striking that it works. And recently, you may have heard a lot of excitement in the string community for something called ADS-CFT holographic duals to QCD. It's really this paper that's kicking it off. What they end up with after they come down from 10 dimensions and there's a particular configuration of brains where they create a D equal 5 defect and then they compactify an S1, they end up with exactly this configuration of quarks on the left brain, quarks on the right brain. And they quote obtaining what I'm going to show you how to obtain, but they don't tell me how to do it. And I have some quibbles over what they claim. But, you know, I think once you get into this construction, you can see pretty that this is obviously going to go through. It's just a hell of a lot of work. Okay, so what is the Chern-Simons term? Well, in three dimensions, it's very simple. It's ADA. And you might ask, why does this thing exist? And the reason it exists is, remember the Dirac monopole in three dimensions. The Dirac monopole is a solenoid that ends at a point and magnetic flux comes out. And Dirac said, I have to hide the solenoid. And so I have to hide it from electron scattering. And that means the Bohm-Aronhoff phase for an electron looping around the solenoid must be a multiple of 2 pi. And so Dirac calculated from that that the magnetic charge was 2 pi over E. And when you do that, the flux, the vector potential wrapping around, line integral around the vector potential is a multiple of 2 pi. Now, you can add to the action this object in three dimensions. And it is asking a question about that solenoid. It's very much like string theory. Suppose you take the solenoid and make a closed loop of Dirac solenoid. And you take another closed loop of Dirac solenoid. And now you link them. Well, if they're linked, this thing integrates to a number. If they're unlinked, it integrates to zero. And it's not hard to see that. So again, if you really want to hide Dirac solenoid, you must make sure that that number is a multiple of 2 pi. And that dictates the coefficient that appears in front of the Chern-Simons term. And it gives exactly the anomaly in two dimensions. Now, when you go to five dimensions, there's a Chern-Simons term. And in fact, it's just ADADA. And what this means is that the solenoid is now carrying DADA. So in three dimensions, the solenoid was just carrying DA, which is the magnetic field. In five dimensions, the solenoid is carrying magnetic field cross magnetic field. And what's flowing out of the point defect is a DADA. And, of course, D of that is zero. So it satisfies a Coulomb. It satisfies the del dot E equals zero, if you like, del dot B equals zero. And, again, there's a coefficient here that would measure the linking of two of these solenoids in five dimensions. If you calculate that, you get 1 over 24 pi squared on the back of an envelope. And we'll see that that is related directly by factor 2 to this 1 over 48 pi squared. So this thing that took a lot of work can be gotten very easily. And this generalizes into any dimension of dA to the d over d minus 1 over 2 in the flux in any d. And the magnetic monopole is that dA to the d minus 1 over 2. And the coefficient you can get. And I did this as an exercise. Then I found the papers of Frampton and Kephart who do the anomaly in any dimension and it matches exactly. So the anomaly in any dimension is determined just by something you can do in the back of an envelope. Anomalies live in even dimension. The corresponding Chern-Simons term lives in the odd dimension just above. Now, in five-dimensional Yang-Mills, there are also Chern-Simons terms. In fact, that'll be true in any dimension. However, Yang-Mills is topologically maximally interesting in five dimensions. Now, I initially thought I'd remembered Witten saying that. But no, it wasn't Witten who said that. I asked Witten, and he said, no, I didn't say that. But I now remember it was at a Chinese lunch in Cambridge where Khumrum Bafa said this. And I remember thinking a lot about that. I had talked to Witten about that time about a related issue on this slide. But I was wondering, what does he mean by that? So my interpretation of what he means by that is the following. there's something that goes back to the early 70s called Dazer's theorem. And Dazer said, in what dimension does pure Yang-Mills, without any fermions, have a stable topological soliton, a lump configuration that carries mass and it's stable? And he proved it was in five dimensions. You can go study his paper. Pierre Ramond came to Fermilab as a visitor about 6 years ago and said, you know, these guys working in extra dimensions pay no attention to topology. Maybe we should start looking at that. And he said, now what's this about Dazer's theorem? So we started looking at Dazer's theorem, and we looked through the literature. We could find not many references to this paper. Nobody had figured out what he was talking about. And then it just dawned on us, he must be talking about the instanton. The instanton is a four-dimensional Euclidean configuration. It's a tunneling amplitude in D equal 4. In D equal 5, it's just a space-like hypersurface of fixed time. If you put an instanton on that, it's a pure gauge configuration. But it may untie itself. What ensures that it doesn't untie itself? So we played around. We realized there were two currents we could write down. One current is strictly conserved. Another current is covariantly conserved. This current requires a D symbol for your group, so it only exists for SU3 and up in the SUN sequence. This current is always present, so it exists for SU2. And so with a little thought, we realized that this thing is just measuring, its charge is conserved, and it's just measuring GG dual, the Pontryagin index of the configuration. This thing is measuring flavor transitions of how you embedded, the instanton, remember, is an SU2 configuration. These symbols measure how SU2 is embedded into a larger group. And so this current is just a flavor transition current. It's measuring, you know, I spin flips to U spin or V spin transitions. So these two currents are there. And now you can ask a deeper question. If those currents are there, where did they come from? If you just wrote the kinetic term for five-dimensional Yang-Mills and vary it and do Noether's theorem, you won't generate these currents. So you already need some kind of UV completion of Yang-Mills in five dimensions just to generate these currents. This current is generated by this object. This object is called the Chern-Simons term, or the second Chern character. And it looks like a real mess. In fact, all it is if you go to six dimensions and you write trace dA, dA, trace GGG in six dimensions. So I got a six-dimensional epsilon symbol tying it together, epsilon. Okay. This can always be written as D of something. And the sixth component of that something is this. Remember, if you've got trace of GG, it's just D of K, where K is trace of, I think, dA, ADA plus two-thirds of dA, A cubed. That we sometimes call Bardeen's current. So Bardeen showed that the divergence of this was GG dual. And that happens, that relationship holds. In any even dimension, you can write the generalization of GG dual as the divergence of something. And it's the one component of that, one dimension down, is the corresponding Chern-Simons term. So this generates the adjoint current. So when Ed Witten was visiting, I asked him, well, what generates this current? And he said, well, just go, of course, to the next, if you're in SUN, go to SUN plus 1 and look at the next diagonal generator. So if you're in SU3, go to SU4 and look at lambda 15, and that'll generate this current, that sort of enveloping extended group structure. Okay, so I bought that answer, but then I thought, but that doesn't really answer the question, because the question is, what do I have to UV complete the theory with? What you have to do is introduce an auxiliary object with a new gauge field, a new U1 gauge field. If you introduce the new U1 gauge field, it will generate this current. It's a massive gauge field. It'll generate the current as the source term for this equation of motion. This object generates this current as the source term for the gauge field configuration, gauge field equation of motion. Now, an astonishing thing happens if you think of four-dimensional chiral Lagrangians, just pionic Lagrangians. There are two currents, something called the Goldstone-Wilczek current and the adjoint currents. There's a topologically stable object in four-dimensional chiral Lagrangians called the skirmion. This is its baryon number. These are the transition currents for the skirmion. The skirmion is the holographic image of the instanton in five dimensions. This thing becomes the full Vesemino-Witten term that generates the skirmionic currents. In fact, it does the pion processes I described. Another thing it does is it fixes the spin and statistics of the skirmion. Skirmion is a baryon. If you have two of them and you rotate them around in the path integral, you have to pick up that's an exchange. You have to pick up a minus sign by Fermi statistics, Pauli statistics. This term is essential that happened. And in fact, I suspect it does. I haven't checked it yet, but there's a lot to be done to understand what this instanton is. I think this is providing odd spin and statistics for the instantonic soliton in five dimensions as well. And this object, so that becomes the Vesemino term. You might ask, what does this become? And I believe I know what this becomes in a chiral Lagrangian. It's never been written down. It's the sigma. It's the Vesemino term for the Goldstone-Wilczek current. And that object picks up a left and a right-handed piece. The sum is just the sigma field. The difference is the eta prime. So you actually get two new currents. You get the U1 axial current out of this for the chiral Lagrangian, and you get the Goldstone-Wilczek current. So that has never been discussed because purists usually just talk about the low energy part of the theory. They don't care about the sigma or the eta prime. But in fact, if you follow the line of reasoning I'm going to show you, it's clear this should be added into the chiral Lagrangians as well. And the dimensional descent will take care of what it gives you. So there's this exact mathematical matching. The instanton in five dimensions is the skirmion. The gauge currents become chiral currents. And therefore, it should be true that Chern-Simons term and boundary term become the Vesemino-Witten term. This is a one-hour talk, isn't it? Yeah. All right. So let's go back to QED, because QED is conceptually easier. The actual derivation of the Vesemino term is beyond anybody's one-hour seminar, so I'll just mention it at the end. So what do we have? We have an orbifold. We have a bulk covariant derivative. We have a bulk field strength. We have a bulk Lagrangian for the photon. We have a left-handed photon, fermion living here. It feels the left-handed gauge field. We have a right-handed fermion living here. It feels the right-handed gauge field. We have a Wilson line that's e to the I line integral of A5 dx5 running from left to right. We can therefore write the electron mass as a bilocal operator, psi bar left, W psi right. M. That operator will be multiplicatively renormalized. It will not receive additive divergence corrections. So it's technically natural in that sense. Now, orbifold boundary conditions, you're probably familiar with the usual orbifolding instructs you to classify wave functions on twice the physical interval. So here's my parallel plate capacitor of two brains. I double the interval. I consider mode functions that are even. So let's see if I get this right. That will be the next mode. Or mode functions that are odd, such as this one. These even parity things are assigned to A mu. The odd parities are assigned to A5. So there's no A5 zero mode when you orbifold. You begin with this object. There's a zero mode, which is the photon, in A mu, and then there's the next KK mode, which would be the axial photon, etc. Okay, that's Harava-Witten. Physically, I don't like to state boundary conditions that way, because I don't really know if you're preserving gauge invariance. But in fact, you are preserving gauge invariance, because these boundary conditions are equivalent to the sort of Jackson style of saying you have a field strength FAB, you have a normal vector eta A, define eta A to be zero on the boundaries. Okay. If you do that, then that means that the fifth component of this is zero. That means d5 a mu minus d mu a5 is zero. But if d5 a mu is zero, the slope of a mu at the boundary must be zero. So did I do something wrong? Yeah, I did something wrong. This is even parity. This is odd parity. Did I do it wrong? So the slope is zero. So this is an even parity thing. The odd parity thing has non-zero slope. So that's the A5 state. D mu A5 must be zero. Therefore, A5 must be zero on the boundary. D5A mu must be zero. Therefore, its slope is zero. So this gives the orbit folding. I had it backwards. Good. That checked it. So that is a magnetic superconductor. That, if you think about the boundary conditions a la Jackson, this is flipped. It's the dual of a boundary condition for a superconductor. Magnetic superconductors are confining phases. So what you have is you sandwich five dimensions between two parallel plates that have confinement. And that's what locks these fields into a Parabolic-Witten boundary condition. If you flip this to find the dual, which is now three index object, and to find this to be zero on a boundary, you will get flipped Parabolic-Witten. You'll assign A mu to be odd parities, A5 to be even parities. You'll get the A5 zero mode, the A mu. So you can play the game. This statement of a boundary condition is gauge invariant, just as this statement of a boundary condition is gauge invariant. So Haraba-Witten boundary conditions or flipped boundary conditions do not break gauge invariants. Now you can handle them in such a way, typically truncating the infinite tower will break gauge invariants, just like a momentum space cutoff in a field theory breaks gauge invariants. But at least you're not breaking it from the boundary conditions themselves. And so I'm not sure if that has ever been stated, but it's true. Now, if we do the gauge transformations in five dimensions, we just shift the photon by the gradient. The wave function on the left picks up the shift field at the origin. Wave function on the right picks it up at R. The Brain fermion action will shift by this, just replacing with d mu, there should be a d mu theta there. And if I integrate by parts, it means I'll get a theta on the left times the divergence of the left current minus theta on the right, divergence of the right current. But these fermions that live on the brains are vial spinners. They have anomalies, and they have the atomic anomaly. It's unambiguous. The left-handed current has this anomaly. The right-handed current has this anomaly. Therefore, our theory is not invariant due to the anomalies, and we run the risk that it's not consistent. However, the Chern-Simons action takes this form, and under the shift in A, you pick up a del A theta here, and you can integrate that. This is a total divergence. It's an exact differential, and it integrates to an anomaly on the left and an anomaly on the right. So adding together the shift from the fermions, which has the consistent anomalies, to the shift from the Chern-Simons term, we see that these will cancel if the coefficient is 1 over 24 pi squared. That's the coefficient I told you would get on the back of an envelope if you maintain Gauss linking and hid the solenoid. All right, so let me just give you a quick reminder. You can fish all this out of Bill Bardeen's paper and a lot more because he does the full Yang-Mills case. It's also in my technical note on the web, this little table. So a left-handed fermion coupled to a left-handed gauge field has an unambiguous anomaly. The right-handed has this anomaly. You can just form the sum of the currents and call that the vector current. And from the sum of left and right is V. The difference is A. So you see the vector current is not conserved. The axial current is not conserved. So this was the original puzzle of anomalies. These are called consistent anomalies because they're just consistent with the atomic anomaly of the left-handed sphere. If you take a mass term and you calculate at low momentum, the anomaly is actually the right-hand side of the Dirac equation of motion. Of divergence of current now involves a mass term. And if the currents, if the external momenta are small, the currents themselves do not have the normal anomaly form. They involve left-right and right-right pieces, and right-left-right and left-left pieces on the right-handed current. It's with the presence of the mass term itself produces a left-left dual, right-right dual, and a left-right dual contribution. So the currents change their structure as you go below threshold. The mass term begins to become part of the anomaly. And written over here, the vector current is still, Dirac equation says it's just divergence of current, it should be conserved, but the anomaly is still 1 over 12 pi squared f vector f axial. The axial current anomaly involves the mass term, and it's 1 over 24 pi squared f vfa. Okay? And the currents, without the masses, have these funny forms, which are basically what you had. There may be a plus a. No, that's correct. So the currents have slightly modified their form. Okay, so those are called the consistent anomalies. They both break gauge invariance. So what people do, or did long ago, is they add a counter term to the theory. And they say, let's add 1 over 6 pi squared axial times vector d vector. And this modifies the definitions of the currents. So the vector current is now modified to be the fermionic piece plus this minus 1 over 3 pi squared ADV and VDA. The axial current is modified to be the fermionic piece plus this VDV. And now, if we calculate the divergence of the full vector current, the anomaly that appeared from the consistent anomaly of the fermionic current is canceled by the divergence of this. This is called the covariant anomaly. The axial current becomes, and this is in the small mass limit, becomes the Adler form. This is what Adler originally calculated. So to naively say that a Weyl spinner has one half of this for its anomalies is dead wrong, because you have this counterterm structure that's needed. Moreover, you can't consistently talk about anomalies, even in QED, without introducing the axial vector photon. Anomalies almost always involve a large manifold, and you're living on some subspace, and you have to make a variation out of the space you're in and come back into it in order to derive the currents. So to get the full currents, I had to introduce a heavy axial vector photon. Now, it's massive, it's heavy, and its current will have an anomaly. At the end of the day, I can set the axial field to zero. So this is what is always argued to be the QED anomaly. But we sort of had to vaguely go through this patching up of gauge invariance to get at it. And what we'll see in a moment is the five-dimensional theory automatically gives it to you, because it was engineered to be gauge invariant and chiral. And notice something else, very important. If you go to the low mass limit for the covariant anomaly, the divergence of the vector current is still zero. The equation of motion of the axial current is still the Adler form of the anomaly, or I should say it's Bardeen's form, because he included the FA, FA. But the currents themselves become divergence-less. The anomaly completely cuts out of the covariant current. The covariant anomaly goes to zero on the currents by themselves. What this means is, if you integrate out the fermions and write a Dirac determinant that is a function of A and V, it must be precisely minus this, because it is the thing that generates the current, the currents themselves and their divergences. So that decoupling of the currents. By the way, this happens to be why Jack Steinberger, who first calculated pi to 2 gamma, got the right answer. Because he did essentially the calculation of the mass term contribution to the anomaly. He said, well, you know, pi goes to 2 gamma through psi bar e to the I pi on gamma psi, e to the I gamma 5 pi on psi. And he just calculated the mass term contribution. Well, because of decoupling, which happens for the covariant anomaly of the currents, that is the right answer. So the first calculation was right, but the mystery of the whole structure of it was a lot of disentanglement. And you can see this is extremely important, and I think it's fundamental to the whole game, the current decoupling. And it's the basis of Tehuft consistency of the anomaly structure on all scales. So if I say the anomalies at some high energy have to match anomalies at low energy, that's true, but the particle may decouple, which means as you descend below its mass scale, the anomaly is entirely inherited to the mass term. And the currents are now conserved. So this is an apparent violation of Tehuft's anomaly consistency. But it's not really, because it's the mass term, the virtue for a very heavy decoupled fermion that defines the anomaly in that limit. Okay, so technically natural QED in five dimensions was this structure. We've got the Chern-Simons term, we've got the left-handed fermions, we've got the Wilson-Line mass term. Everything is technically natural. Everything is strictly anomaly-free. Now let's manipulate this. So the first thing to do to manipulate it is pass to axial gauge. A5 is 0. To pass to axial gauge, we introduce a gauge transformation that goes from the left brain out into the bulk by an amount e to the I line integral of A5. And that has the effect of mapping the A5 everywhere in the bulk to zero. This is not a non-trivial topological situation you've wrapped around a flux. So it's possible, therefore, to remove A5 from the bulk. So you're just living on an orbifold. When you do this, the Chern-Simons term becomes this expression, an integral over y from one brain to the other of b mu, b nu, fb, where b is the transformed field. This gauge transformation does a number of miracles. The main thing it does is it packages all of the massive modes, the higher KK modes that have mass, will eat now the nth A5 mode. Where this is the first, so the first meets the derivative of this and so forth. And those are called Stoeckelberg fields because they're gauge invariant. You shift that by gradient of theta, and you shift that by theta. So this gauge transformation repackages all vector, all massive fields into Stoeckelberg form. And it leaves us with this Chern-Simons term. Now let's do the orbifold mode expansion on the Stoeckelbergs. And, in fact, it's consistent to do it on the Stoeckelbergs. Everything gets packaged with the same basis function. And you just go through, and this is, I'm going to speed up a little bit. So you get a tower of KK mode kinetic terms, a tower of masses, mn squared, n is just the nth level. The coupling constants get properly renormalized. And you end up now with the Chern-Simons term in the mode expansion. If you substitute in the modes, the mode expansion here, here, and here, and do the integrals, you find you're doing this integral. You're picking up a minus sign, that's a consistent minus sign factor, and you get this result. So you get a set of coefficients. From the Chern-Simons term, they're measuring interactions of the nth with the mth and kk mode. And you might look at those and think, is there something special about those coefficients? They are, after all, in some sense, topologically significant. What are they? So they actually do have a lot of significance. And in fact, you better get the same answer if the background manifold was Randall-Sundrum as it is in a flat manifold, and you'll see why in a moment. So let's look at our D equal 4 effective theory. So now I can just rewrite a vector field, the sum of all the even KK modes, an axial vector, the sum of all the odds, and just write things like this in the Dirac form. And I've got my Chern-Simons interaction, I've got my K0 mode, my KK mode towers, and my mass tower. Notice if we truncate our theory on the 0 mode, which is the photon, and the first KK mode, B1, truncate this entire thing down, so we've just got the photon and the first F1, and the mass term for F1. This thing goes into the form exactly 1 over 6 pi squared A V D. So the Chern-Simons term is doing exactly, is playing exactly the role of the counter term. And it's turning, it's making the theory gauge invariant. So the currents are now going to be in the covariant form. And the zero mode photon will be completely gauge invariant. So we can derive, in fact, the full set of currents. So vary that action I just showed you with respect to the nth KK mode, and that'll pull down a vector current for the even ends, an axial current for the odd ends, and a piece that you get by varying the Chern-Simons term, which has the form, you have to do it on all the fields, so it has the form shown here, this permuted combination of Cn's. Calculate the divergence of the nth current. Well, this is just what I had way back, if we go way back to my little crib sheet, these are the consistent anomalies with exactly the 1 over 12 pi squared. We get a factor of 2 here and another factor of 2 coming from the various permutations of indices. It's a 1 over 12 pi squared of FF dual for the vector and axial vector currents. This is the junk you get now from the Chern-Simons term. So the full anomaly, the divergence of this current, can be written here. It involves those funny indices. It involves the addition of this 1 and minus 1 to the power coming from the fermions. It can be rewritten. Remarkably, this plus this goes into this form, which is precisely the original CNMK times 3 halves. Therefore, those CNMKs are the anomaly coefficients of the theory. And indeed, if we look at the first level, we see that the vector current is conserved. as it is. It must be for the consistent covariant anomaly of QED. And the axial vector current, when we take the first C, is exactly the form, Adler's form plus the axial form. So the theory is doing exactly what it should be doing with its gauge invariant. Now, what are the effects of this physically, this Chern-Simons term? Let's integrate out the fermions. If we take the mass of the fermions large and integrate them out, they will produce, upon integration, a Dirac determinant. The Dirac determinant will have a structure that's identical to the Chern-Simons form, and it'll modify the coefficients from the original C's to C bars. And I told you this has to do with decoupling. The divergences of the currents become zero in this limit. The corrections you get from the Dirac determinant are just minus 1 times the counter term. So, in fact, what we now get is a set of coefficients from, this is from the Dirac determinant given here, which is just the this structure, and it's minus the form of the counter term written, where A is the difference between the left and right-handed KK mode tower, and V is the same. Okay, so our full effective theory, therefore, has C bars that are the C's minus the A's. It takes this form. So let's do something with it. Let's calculate the decay of a KK mode. So now we have a theory in which the fermions have been set away. They're infinite mass. We have a Chern-Simons term, which has the form I wrote before with the C bars now in the coefficients. We have gauge fields. Naively, if you ignore the Chern-Simons term, you'd look at that and say, well, T parity makes the A1 stable. But in fact, the Chern-Simons term says, no, it will be unstable. Well, actually, A1 will be stable. The higher modes will have interactions. So let's calculate the decay of the A-th mode to the B-th and C-th, and let's take C to be the photon. So this is a KK mode to KK mode plus gamma. This is the amplitude. It resolves into two momentum structures. If C is the photon, then it better be true if I replace the photon polarization, which I called epsilon sub gamma here, by Q, then I better get zero. Well, if I replace this by Q, I don't get zero. Therefore, it better be true that this combination of coefficients is exactly zero, and indeed it is. So the eighth mode going to B plus gamma yields this result. You can turn that into partial widths. 1 minus to 1 plus and gamma, given by this. 1 plus and 1 minus to gamma is given by this. And there's some interesting relations here. You see some power law running of the coupling constant appearing in these decaying amplitudes. So this is a standard partial widths. And therefore, the thing is working in a gauge invariant way. It's producing some physics that you wouldn't have in the theory otherwise. Notice that if you did KK mode to zero mode plus zero mode, you get a coefficient of B and A that is identically zero. And that's just the Landau-Yang theorem. You can't have a vector spin one massive field decay to two zero modes. So, what have we done? We've taken DFL5 QED. We have noticed that the KK mode parity is now locked to the parity of spacetime. T parity is no longer an independent symmetry. Lightest KK modes are not stable. The 1 minus will be stable because it could only decay to a pair of photons, and that is disallowed by the Landau-Yang. But this would tend to destabilize towers of KK modes that you might invoke T parity for. Topological interactions are a general feature of extra dimensions. We have these holographic boundary terms and bulk effects. So that's 5D QED to show you more or less how this works. What about Yang-Mills? I'm going to go rather quickly through this. In Yang-Mills, we play the same game. We have Yang-Mills living in the bulk. We put a multiplet fundamental representation on the left brain, fundamental on the right. We have the path-ordered line integral of B5. We write down a mass term. Now we identify the Wilson line as chiral mesons. And I'm interested now in any compactification scheme which makes B5 a zero mode. Now, what the string people like to do is they like to go around S1 and have a small gap. And they put the Wilson line on the gap. And they talk about that compactification, where the mass term is essentially given by this. And the F pi again, is proportional to 1 over r, so they can essentially take the f pi arbitrarily large by shrinking the gap. This is equivalent to what I'm doing if there's no magnetic flux inside S1, because then this Wilson line and this Wilson line are equal but opposite. So, in fact, I'm just saying any configuration such as this will suffice, and I can, in fact, use the flipped orbital full boundary conditions where the pion is the zero mode and the AMU is zero heavy. The argument still goes through. So what we have is the same situation. We have the Chern-Simons term, which is balancing the anomalies. So it's canceling anomalies on the left brain and the right brain. We're going to integrate out the fermions in the large mass limit. That's going to produce a Dirac determinant. And the overall theory is anomaly-free. The Dirac determinant, I call that the boundary term, will produce anomalies. The Chern-Simons term compensates. There's a sort of a closed loop of anomaly flux. The theory is anomaly-free. They say the theory requires the Yang-Mills Chern-Simons term, and under a gauge transformation, that produces effects on the boundary. Well, what it produces is exactly the consistent anomaly on the boundary. So here again, the anomalous current, people often get confused, the anomalous current of Yang-Mills is not trace TA-GG dual. It isn't even a gauge covariant operator. The consistent anomaly is this thing. It's not gauge invariant, not gauge covariant, I should say. This was first worked out in Bardeen's paper, and this relationship between the Chern-Simons term and the consistent anomaly was first noticed by Jakeef some years ago. And again, the cancellation requires the 1 over 24 pi squared, and n is some integer, would be the number of colors in our case. Again, you can get that from the generalization of the Dirac. That's the same as the U1 case. Again, we transform to axial gauge, and this takes a little bit of explaining, but what I'm doing again is a bulk transformation. This repackages all of the fields into Stuckelberg form in the bulk with this U of y. U tilde I can take to be any function of y that goes from 0 to a constant, but for simplicity, I'm just taking it to be linear. And in fact, if you already know the pion parity is pseudoscalar and it's the 0 mode, that linear function is necessary to have it couple longitudinally to the A1 and other mesons. One final difficult manipulation is that you have to turn this into a form that works in axial gauge. So you write it as a D5 and an A5 piece, and it becomes this form, which Sakos and I did in an earlier paper. This is the axial gauge form of the Chern-Simons terms, where A5 has been set to 0. And we will now turn this into form notation. And for me, form notation is simply not writing any of the indices, not writing the epsilon symbol. It's there, and being very careful about order. So the field strength, the 2 form, is just 2 dB minus 2 IB squared, for example. Okay. Integrate out the fermions. We see that produces minus 1 times Bardeen's determinant, counterterm. The counterterm you can look up in his paper. I didn't actually calculate it for Yang-Mills. I checked that the kinetic term part, the DAs work out fine. But in fact, I didn't get the full structure. So at this stage, I'm just using the fact that this worked in QED. It must be true in Yang-Mills. So here we are. Our gauge fields have now been gauge transformed. They pick up corrections that are chiral currents. The chiral currents live in the bulk. We simply substitute this form for the gauge field into the Chern-Simons term and into the boundary term. And you see it's starting to get rather messy. Let's focus on one of the terms. Let's focus on the piece that's built purely out of alpha. That's e to the I, y, pi mesons, d mu, e to the minus I, y, pi mesons. It's minus 4 alpha cubed plus 3 alpha cubed, this y integral. And if you just do the integral, it turns out here's an exact relationship. You have to expand it in pions. If you expand it in pions, you get the leading term, dy y to the fourth, trace pi d pi to the fourth with this coefficient. Do the integral. You get exactly Witten's form with Witten's quantized coefficient, 2 over 15. You can look up in Witten's original paper. So, in fact, this thing is giving you the Vesemino term as an exact, well, it's a form. This is not a holographic term. This is a bulk-filling term. And it's giving the same power series structure that Vesa and Zimino give you. But if we go back and look at other terms, for example, we can look at the dA alpha squared terms. After some massaging, this goes into the form A right beta cubed. Now, it should be parity symmetric. But if you go back here, you'll notice that the gauge transformation I'm doing starts on the left, so wherever it was, well, the gauge transformation U tilde starts on the left and migrates to the right into the bulk. So the gauge transformation I'm doing breaks parity. It causes the boundary term and the Chern-Simons term to independently fail to respect parity. But if you look at this, you will see that buried in here there is a term A left alpha cubed. And the term we just got was A right beta cubed. And in fact, when we add everything together, we get the full parity symmetric Vesa-Semino-Witten term. So this is the full Witten Vesa-Semino. This is what you get by gauging this object, as Witten originally did. Now, Witten, it was a very difficult calculation. Witten dropped a few terms. It took some time for people to straighten it out. There are a number of follow-on papers. The final form that I like is given by Kamakalan, Rajiv, and Schechter, who used it to study vector meson decay processes and a lot of the non-trivial physics. This agrees exactly with them. It is a holographic interaction. So what has happened is our Chern-Simons term plus Dirac determinant has produced the holographic piece, but there's also a leftover piece. This piece by itself contains all of the anomaly structure of the pure chiral Lagrangian. So it's hard to see it, but if you did a left-handed transformation on U, so U now runs from 0 to R, so the line, it runs all the way across the bulk, A5, so it's the full e to the I mesons. Okay. If you do a left-handed transformation on U, let's say, and you correspondingly do a transformation on A left, which is just d epsilon plus a commutator, this thing will produce the consistent anomaly. It will produce the term epsilon dA squared minus I over 2 dA cubed on the left. So it contains the full consistent anomaly structure for both left and right. And it also contains all the interactions of pions with left gauging and right gauging. So the rho meson would be a vector. The A1 meson would be an axial vector. And you could substitute all of this in here and you would get all the correct physical processes that anomalies are involved in. This contrasts significantly from the normal derivation of Vesa-Semino where you promote the pions to five dimensions. Witten wrote down what he called a Hopf invariant, which was the trace of five currents. So these things are just U dagger dA, du, where U is e to the I, 2i pi over f. And if you expand in mesons, you'll typically get the leading order term d pi, and then you can pull the d out. D of each of these currents is zero, so then you can integrate it to the form pi d pi to the fifth. We talked about the gauging of this structure in six dimensions, in five dimensions, but when you go to each of the terms become exact differentials, you can integrate them out, and the full structure becomes the thing I described. Here, it's not at all obvious that this is going to be a gauge invariant structure because this breaks gauge invariance through the anomalies. At the end of the day, you have to check that, in fact, it just reproduces the anomaly structure. So the Kamakalan, Rajiv, Schechter form was the perfection of that approach and, in fact, got it right, and the full structure is contained there. Here we have started with a Yang-Mills theory in five dimensions on a particular structure. We have a fully gauge invariant structure, and we've descended to the four-dimensional effective theory, and the anomaly structure must be preserved. And there's no anomaly in our theory, so we have to understand that in a moment. What has happened is we got the Vesa-Semino term plus a non-holographic piece, which I call S-bulk. And if you manipulate S bulk, you see it has precisely the form of the original Chern-Simons term written in our gauge, involving all the heavy fields. Well, the Chern-Simons term produces the anomalies on the boundary. The Rajiv-Schechter-Kamakalan holographic structure produces the anomalies on the boundary. They cancel. And that's how this theory maintains the full gauge invariance. It gives a holographic piece, which is the WZW and the bulk piece, which compensates the anomalies. So if you were doing a chiral Lagrangian, you'd just say, throw that out. If you're doing a little Higgs theory, you can't throw that out. If you're really doing an A5 is Higgs theory, you can't throw that out. So the physics will be slightly different, depending upon how you engineer it. I'm going to leave that alone. So in summary, the Vestimino-Witten term has been derived from the D equal 5 Chern-Simons term plus the Dirac determinant. We find exact matching of the D equal 5 Yang-Mills to the D equal 4 chiral Lagrangian. The instantonic soliton is the skirmion. The gauge currents for the instanton will become the skirmionic currents in the chiral Lagrangian. The D equal 5 Chern-Simons term also, as we've seen, yields new bulk physics that isn't generally appreciated. And this will be present in most models that people are using nowadays in extra dimensions. This was set up largely pedagogically just to see what's going on. And amongst the applications, the one we're working on now is directly applying this to the Kaplan-Schmoltz model, which is the simplest little Higgs theory. I actually think it's the nicest little Higgs theory. And I actually think it's quite interesting that you can construct a UV completion of this theory, and as far as I can tell, I do a Nabu-Jonah-Lucinio approximation of the dynamics, I'm led to a unique color structure, and that's surprising. I can't have an arbitrary color group. And the gauging is sort of spelled out, but if you want to reproduce the minimal two-triplet Kaplan-Schmoltz model, you're led to a fairly unique UV structure. And all of the Chern-Simons junk comes through. The subtlety is that, I'll tell you, that in the Rajiv-Schechter form of the Vestimino-Witten term, you actually have a linear chiral symmetry in the sense that U transforms as e to the I epsilon left, e to the minus I epsilon right. That's a linear transformation. It's bilinear, but it's linear. In Kaplan-Schmoltz, you have to learn nonlinear realizations where U transforms as some e to the I epsilon left with a compensator. The compensator is a function of epsilon left and the pions. Okay. And that means there's no ordinary derivative. The ordinary derivative of this under a global transformation is covariant. The ordinary derivative of this is not. You immediately led to covariant derivatives involving meson fields. And that significantly modifies what I just discussed. And at the end of the day, we get a Vestimino-Witten term, but it's rather tricky. And actually, for the Kaplan-Schmoltz model, which is quite nice, it simplifies considerably. So there is physics. And in fact, what happens in Kaplan-Schmoltz, I'll just tell you, you have an SU3 gauging of a triplet called phi. The analog of the K-star coset field will decay to the little Higgs plus a Z boson. So in particular, E plus E minus machines could make the Higgs in concert with this K-star through the anomaly. And that will count the number of prions that make up the little Higgs. By the K-star, I just mean the thing that lives in the slot where the kaons are. There's a W and Z living up here where the pions would be. Here's the K-star, and then something that's like an eta. And you'll have this physical process codified in the Vestimino term. And I think that's a very interesting thing to shoot for in ILC. It looks like it's marginal with the baseline parameters. It depends, of course, on the mass of this, which is typically F. That's 100 JeV, and that's an order of TeV. You need maybe a muon collider or a very high-energy click machine to see an effect like that. But that would be probing and counting the number of colors inside the Higgs or the constituents of the Higgs. Okay, that's all. That's a lot.
Thank you. So, if you just take very small extra dimensions in all of this, is there anything surprising out of this? Anything that people have done wrong in the past?
I think that, as I say, I mean, it would be like ignoring the Vesemino term in a chiral Lagrangian. But you see that when pi goes to 2 gamma. My hope was originally that I would see with little Higgs theories operators like, well, so think of pi, d pi, d pi, d pi, d pi. And that becomes k, d pi, d pi, d pi, dk. There are no pions, by the way, in Kaplan-Schmaltz. And if you look at this thing, you find there's another term, which is eta t8 dk, dk bar, dk, dk bar, which is also present in this object in SU theory. And actually, what that is measuring is the mapping of the surface of a sphere to a sphere, because it's got five coordinates. This is essentially eta going to k plus, k minus, k naught, k naught bar. It's that interaction. So I thought, looking at this, that this would become a Higgs, this would become a Higgs, and these would become longitudinal W and Z, and then I'd end up with something like epsilon mu or sigma Higgs dagger W mu, W mu, Z, W, we'll call it Z rho, plus minus D sigma Higgs. And I'd say, aha, that's a very interesting possibility of manufacturing pairs of Higgs bosons from this. But it turns out when the Higgs gets its VEV and this thing ceases to be H dot dagger, this has to have odd CP. So you need an odd CP part of the scalar mixing with the even CP. It's zero. So there is no contribution like this. It's not until you get into these models where the Higgs carries strangeness and you make the corresponding gauge boson that has strangeness that you get new physics. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of physics that's being left out. For example, Agassi builds the Higgs, I mean, Randall-Sundrum model, out of an incomplete, non-anomaly canceling multiplicity on the UV brain, and he has the top right on the IR brain. There's therefore a large Chern-Simons term structure filling the bulk, and it'll have these bulk interactions. And people talk about the gravitational effects in those theories, you better figure out what the gravitational Chern-Simons term looks like. Look at how that it modifies production, et cetera. I mean, the physics is simply being left out. And I hear these talks where people do these spin to, this Joanne Hewitt paper with the whole resonance production of sequences of spin twos. Well, the decay modes are going to be modified significantly by the inclusion of this term. I haven't looked at that. I mean, it's probably a real bear, but that's something to worry about. So yes, the answer is yes. They've left all sorts of things out. Any other questions?
So how do these results compare to Sakai and Sugimoto?
Well, Sakai and Sugimoto, as I recall, get to essentially this construction, which we had done earlier. And they then say a tedious calculation of the Chern-Simons term together with the Dirac determinant yields the Vesemino term. It's true. But what they have is a gauge invariant structure. So in fact, that calculation gives a holographic piece that's the Vesemino term plus a bulk piece that's the Chern-Simons term written in this gauge. They don't tell me that. And they don't seem to remember that they've got a gauge invariant construction. So when they do the variation, the anomalies better cancel. So as I said, if you want to get back QCD, you would have to, this would be the answer, this is the answer they would claim to get. But they're also getting this piece, and they don't mention that piece. They also don't tell me how they got this answer. I mean, I could say at this point, well, it better work, okay? But I found it took a few years to figure this thing out. And they come along and say, it works. Well, okay, show me, and then tell me what happened to this piece. And so that piece is shown here, is the Chern-Simons term in my form, where I've gone to A5 equals zero gauge in the heavy fields. And it's non-holographic, and it describes the bulk interactions. So for example, if I was doing an Agassi-like model, there'd be a lot of physics in this term that I'd have to worry about. And I told you in QED how the KK modes decay. I just did the A to B and B plus C example. All of that physics would be contained here, but now it's got gravitational structure as well. So so in that sense, we began this enterprise and got the best amino term from deconstruction several years ago, and I was sort of midway through this analysis when I saw Sakai and Sugimoto appear, so they didn't enlighten me because they didn't show me how to do the calculation. This calculation is done in all of its detail in the paper called Exact Equivalence of Chen Simons and Vesino, which I put on the web last January or February or something. We are thinking of having a workshop on string holographic duality of QCD, however, because I think there's a lot more going on there than. But I must say, I haven't learned anything from it, because they tell me things like, for the first time, we know how to apply Nambu Jonal Asinio to QCD. Well, I've been reading papers for 15 years, 20 years, where people do that. And the difference is that for the first time, we have a pathway from the Planck scale down to the chiral phase transition of QCD in a string theory. But I remember Ken Wilson telling me, if I'm at the QCD scale, I don't have to worry about the Planck scale. And so I haven't learned what I've added by climbing from the Planck scale down to the QCD scale. And I think somehow the string theorists never read any Ken Wilson papers. Simply don't know about decoupling. So.
If they had, they wouldn't be string theorists.
I didn't say that, but I could have. No, I mean, it's true. They simply don't think in the language of decoupling. You don't have to worry about the chiral constituent quark model. Murray Gell-Mann in the 70s used to say, the Harry Lipkin models don't make any sense. And that sounded like just an insult, but in fact what he meant was the heavy quark mass, the 300 MeV constituent quark mass, makes no sense without pions. Because the quarks are light. They're essentially massless. That mass is dynamical, and it must have the Nambu-Goldstone bosons. So it must have psi bar left, e to the I pi over f, psi right. When you write them, those pions have to be there. In fact, Howard Georgi told me that Steve Weinberg used to say all the same things at Harvard. You know, somebody should blend the pions together with the quarks. So finally, Howard and Anish Manohar wrote that up. That's what Georgi says. Well, we finally wrote it up. And they wrote this beautiful thing, which we call the chiral constituent quark model, or the Anish Manohar-Georgi model, where you keep the pions and the quarks. And you do the dynamics by integrating out the quarks. And what's astonishing to me is a whole literature on this, Binion's, Theron, de Raphael, etc., of fitting QCD with this. They even keep the four pion Gasser-Leutwiller operators, higher derivative operators, and you get astonishingly good fit to the chiral physics of QCD by doing this. So confinement is just the act of integrating out the quarks. And you get this effective theory. Now the Vesemino term, I've shown you now how you can do that too. You would keep, you have to interpret the pion topologically as the fifth component of a vector potential, add the Chern-Simons term in, and integrate out the quarks. And that'll produce that as well. So I'm really doing the chiral constituent quark model, but sort of unifying all the fields in five dimensions. And did that for QED to show you what was going on. So again, if you want to understand the anomaly structure of four dimensions, you really have to look at the five-dimensional chirally delocalized theory and then and put the Chern-Simons term in. Because that contains a lot of the physics. But I don't learn much by reading these holographic dual papers. They just, you know, they end up finally with this five-dimensional structure. That's where I find it interesting. Talked to Witten not so long ago, and he was absolutely fascinated by the holographic dual stuff, but it seemed to me he was only interested in the brain sandwiches that you need these body defects to get it all to work. He wasn't interested in this low energy part, which I find astonishing because he played such a major role in developing the Vesemino-Witten term. So. Mm-hmm. But anything to get the string theorists back in the four dimensions, we're willing to encourage. So Jeff Harvey has been interested in this stuff, and we're planning on some kind of workshop. And one of the questions they ask is, how much separation is there between the chiral phase transition and the confinement phase? And you don't need string theory to ask that question. You can just ask. We were asking that question with heavy light mesons several years ago. There's another application of this, which is to set up a theory of heavy light mesons, with heavy mesons living in the, on brains with light mesons. I believe there may be topologically interesting interactions that happen in that, that theory as well. But one thing we were interested in is how to restore chiral symmetry in the B meson system or the D meson system. What will happen then is the zero plus states and zero minus states will collapse together, form a super chiral supermultiplet. And the D sub S zero plus state is quite narrow because it wants to be K to K plus D. And it's so light that that channel is blocked. If that channel were open, this would be so broad you wouldn't see it. And it is exactly the parity partner of the ground state. And so you write a chiral Lagrangian. What you have in mind is turning off the mass gap, which comes from the strange quark S bar S condensate in QCD. So Bill Bardeen suggested a four Fermi interaction, and you can imagine turning up the strength of that. It's repulsive in the S bar S channel and restore the chiral symmetry. You can see that parity doubling happen. I don't need string theory to tell me how to do something like that. So, again, I'm probing the, you know, the chiral transition here relative to maintaining confinement, but restoring chiral symmetry, which you can do in that theory. Okay. Enough string theory bashing.